number 25-1201, Trujillo v. Amity Plaza. Please proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Jessica McBryant and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Catherine Trujillo. This case concerns the fundamental right of a tenant to be safe in their own home, a right protected by the Fair Housing Act. The district court granted summary judgment by adopting a dangerously narrow view of vicarious liability, one that effectively grants one free rate to housing providers so long as the perpetrator is a maintenance worker rather than a manager. We ask this court to reverse for three reasons. First, legal error.
First what?
Legal error.
Okay.
The court misapplied the aided in agency exception by requiring supervisory authority, contradicting the restatement second of agency, section 219.2d, and 24 CFR section 100.7b. Second, factual error. The record shows Martinez's agency relationship provided the unique access and color of authority he used to facilitate his assault. And third, procedural error. The court's sua sponte grant of summary judgment in favor of Martinez violated Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 56F.
On the agency, I know you'll deal with this in your own chronology, in your own order, but I'm unclear. Did he have other assigned work in the building, or did he just have it in the area before the rape? I mean, I know he had access to some building. Was it the very building that the victim was living in, or was it a different building but in the complex?
My understanding is he had access to both buildings through the master key, but he was working in the other building in the complex.
So he was working in the other building, and did he need work access to get to the building that the plaintiff was in or not?
No, Your Honor.
He didn't need special access?
No, Your Honor.
Anybody could have walked into that building?
Correct.
Thank you.
Sure. The district court's primary legal error was the imposition of a supervisory requirement that exists nowhere in the law of agency or the Fair Housing Act. The district court may not have labeled its requirement managerial, but by holding that a maintenance worker access and uniform are insufficient to create a nexus, it created a rule where only management-level quid pro quo conduct triggers liability. That is a reversible departure from the FHA's broad remedial purpose and the plain language of the statute.
Well, counsel, let me stop you there, and I appreciate you kind of couching that or your argument in the district court functionally made that rule. I mean, it did not state the rule that you're saying it imposed.
Correct, Your Honor. He did not state that only managers can trigger liability for vicarious liability under the Federal Housing Act. However, his ruling imposed a requirement for quid pro quo conduct.
Meaning what? How does that transfer to a managerial role?
Meaning that, Your Honor. Yes. Meaning that the district court found that if a employee of a housing authority did not have the ability to change the terms of a lease or to restrict management services or things like that. Quid pro quo authority. Because Mr. Martinez.
Well, what's the quid? And you're using that term again, so help me understand what the quid is.
The quid is, if you do not do these sexual favors for me or other things in response, I will not sell this apartment for you, or I will not send out my maintenance worker to you. That is the quid pro quo.
And under. Did he ever say that? Was that ever threatened?
No, Your Honor. And that is our concern with the district court's order, is that he never said that or threatened that. But the final rule, the HUD's final rule, states that there's two types of housing discrimination. The first is section 100.600A1, which is quid pro quo discrimination. The second, A2, is hostile environment discrimination. And that's what occurred here, and the district court did not analyze or consider that type of harassment in his order.
Well, I've stopped you. So what test should be imposed, do you think? What legal test?
Sure, Your Honor. It's a totality of the circumstances test. And it's under the restatement second of agency for the aided in agency exception.
Totality leading to what?
Leading to the harassment.
Well, don't you have to somehow connect the harasser with the victim in some way. Don't you have to come up with a test? You can't say, oh, the totality. Well, I mean, the totality as to what? What is the conclusion?
The conclusion under both the aided in agency and totality of the circumstances, they work together. So aided in agency is that an agent can be liable for, the employer can be liable for the agent's conduct. The totality of the circumstances test is under the final rule, the HUD's final rule, for finding discrimination in housing. So it's based on pervasiveness of contact, severity of contact, things like that. So combining them together, did the employer's granting of access and authority and things like that allow him to pervasively
or... But the employer didn't grant access. Anybody could have had access. You just said that.
Sure, Your Honor, but this is different than a stranger off the street. This was an entire grooming process that occurred over months, and it was facilitated.
You know, on the grooming, I expect there might have been some of that, but it seems to me that this relationship between the defendant and the victim had changed from one of a property owner to one of, she was trying to market some of her artwork through him. And wasn't that the main part of the, I mean, the earlier things to fix things in the apartment was done. So wasn't this a completely unrelated to the apartment, the only interest that the two of them had, other than his ulterior interest, of course, was the only interest she had was not related to being a tenant at all. Isn't that right?
I understand your point, Your Honor, and I believe it's the point that the district court and the defense made in their arguments, but we disagree. Because the relationship began with the targeted meeting that was mandated by the employer.
So and you think once it begins with a tenant-landlord relationship, that controls forever after that?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. That's not the point we are trying to make.
How does it end? It started that way, but you've already agreed that the current relationship was more of a commercial relationship. So if it wasn't destined to last forever because it began as a landlord-tenant relationship, what triggers the end of that? And how does it morph into a traditional, just normal commercial relationship?
And I think that's the point under the totality of the circumstances. And in this circumstance, it started with the targeted meeting and it continued still under his color of authority. In almost all of their meetings, if not all of them, he was wearing a uniform. In all of their contacts over the phone, he was using a work-provided cell phone. And he had a master key. And you can see that...
But he didn't use the master key this time. His uniform didn't matter this time. Anybody had access to this apartment. She had it unlocked, so I just don't see any nexus to his work status and the access that led to the rape.
I understand your point, Your Honor. I think in order to find that nexus, you need to look at Ms. Trujillo's testimony. And her testimony regarding the frequency and length of her meetings and phone calls with Martinez provides the most direct evidence of the aided nature of the harassment. She testified that she did not answer these calls out of personal interest, but because she was intimidated of him and scared of him as a representative of her housing complex who possessed master keys to her home. And that's at volume 3, pages 153 through 159.
Thank you. Go ahead with your, you've answered my questions. Thanks.
Okay. Under the HUD's 2016 final rule, a housing provider's agent holds a position of power and authority over a resident regardless of their specific duties. By requiring a specific work order at the exact moment of the rape, the district court ignored the reality that Martinez's agency status aided every step of his path to her door. And the district court's logic that implies that if an agent cannot evict you or withhold services from you, their harassment doesn't count unless it's quid pro quo. This is directly refuted by the final rule, which states that an agent's power exists regardless of the agent's duties. In addition, 24 CFR section 100.400 C2 provides that interference includes the loss of enjoyment of a dwelling. and 24 CFR section 100.600 A1 and A2 explicitly and plainly outline that there are two types of harassment, one quid pro quo and one hostile environment. By definition, a hostile environment exists when unwelcome conduct is sufficiently severe or pervasive to create an intimidating or offensive living situation. A tenant who is raped in her bedroom by a man with a master key has suffered a total collapse of her housing security and ultimate interference with her privileges of residency, regardless of whether her lease remains intact.
Counsel, can I ask you about what I'll frame as the trend in the law and the application of the exception here? And as your brief, I think, correctly notes, there's not Supreme Court or a lot of circuit law that applies the agency or aided by agency exception in the Fair Housing Act context. But Ellerith, which is not a FHA case, tells us the restatement is a good starting point. But my understanding is you quoted restatement second, but restatement third has removed the aided by agency exception from it because the trend from courts has been to be concerned about how expansive vicarious liability can become. So can you address how we should be thinking of this exception in the FHA context, narrowly or broadly, when it seems like the trend is it should be exceedingly narrow?
Sure, Your Honor. Good question. I think liability should still be limited to cases where the agency relationship actually facilitated the harm. And when a landlord gives a predator a uniform, a paycheck, a company phone, and he used that company phone previously to harass a coworker, and then used that company phone again to harass Ms. Trujillo, they have aided his ability to commit that harassment.
Well, but in the Title VII context, Ellerith talks about proximity and regular contact with sort of a pool of persons that could become victims and how that may not be sufficient. So here, it would seem to me that access to the apartment is key. And you're nodding your head, so I think you agree with that. But Judge Ebell asked, I think, a good point about sort of a nexus between that access and the facts here. So, I mean, if we're going to draw a line on access, it makes me a little uncomfortable to say it's whether or not the door is locked or not. But how can we draw a line as to where access then facilitates this conduct?
I do think it needs to be a case-by-case basis. And in this case, a man in a uniform who wore a ski mask to commit a rape, I don't think that unlocked door would have stopped him. And he had the keys to be able to enter her apartment anyways. Your Honors, if I may reserve additional time, unless you have other questions you'd like me to address. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Shannon Hurley, and I have the privilege of representing Amity Plaza LLC and the Littleton Housing Authority doing business as South Metro Housing Options. I asked to reserve 5 minutes of my time for my co-counsel to address the claims brought against Mr. Martinez. Today, we ask the court affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment for three reasons. First, the district court properly interpreted that the aided by agency theory is based on common law tort principles. Second, there's no question of material fact to support a finding of vicarious liability under the aided by agency doctrine. And third, there's no question of material fact supporting a finding of direct liability for the housing defendants. Turning to point one, the district court properly interpreted the aided by agency doctrine as based on common law principles and strict liability is not appropriate. Plaintiff's argument effectively asks the court to hold that employers are strictly liable for misconduct of the employees in the housing context. Plaintiff contends that the lower court incorrectly concluded that the aided by agency theory only applies to supervisory level conduct, which is not the conclusion the court reached, nor the requirement under the case law. With this argument, plaintiff is asking to expand the application of vicarious liability in the FHA context by arguing the existence of the employment relationship is enough to create a question of fact for the jury. The lower court took the undisputed facts and applied the limited case law in this context and appropriately rejected the argument when granting summary judgment. Furthermore, Supreme Court precedent and HUD regulations do not support adopting a more strict standard of the aided by agency doctrine. For example, in Ellerith, a Title VII case that's often relied upon in the Fair Housing Act cases, noted that the aided by agency requires the existence of something more than the employment relationship itself, because the aided by agency exception allows for the imposition of vicarious liability based on the agent's misuse of delegated authority. Similarly, in Meyer v. Hawley, the Supreme Court overturned a Ninth Circuit opinion that made corporate owners and officers liable for the unlawful acts of their corporate employees because of the right to control. The Supreme Court expressly disagreed with the Ninth Circuit that the FHA extended traditional vicarious liability rules in this way.
Well, counsel, can I stop you there?
Yes.
I understand your argument is that basically your opposing counsel's arguing for any employment relationship is enough, basically. But I think they're arguing you gave the person a master key, a uniform, and superior access to whatever. Isn't that enough to put you over the edge?
Under the...
Oh, and a cell phone, right?
Sorry, could you repeat?
A phone.
Yes. Under the similar district court rulings of LaCour, Pelfrey, and Boswell, there has to be some connection with those, with the delegated authority that was actually used in the commission of the harassment. And here, the court correctly...
Well, how about the phone?
The phone, well, was a work phone. It was, the communication started with and was about his family, problems and his art. There wasn't, the undisputed evidence wasn't that it was sexually harassing in nature, that it was similar to the communications in LaCour, which were initiated by plaintiff after the defendant in that case, the defendant employee had reached out to let the tenant know that they had their application had been approved. And so there has to be an actual connection between the use of the delegated authority and the actual harassment.
Well, aren't they arguing that the phone calls just, it was part of a grooming process? I mean, start friendly and then go somewhere else with the relationship.
I think that the plaintiffs didn't develop that there isn't a, there hasn't been a presentation of material fact that this was in fact grooming. There's no expert opinions or testimony on that for plaintiff to rely on that to create a dispute of material fact. And the focusing on the facts that aren't in dispute and that are supported by the record doesn't show that this was necessarily grooming, that Ms. Trujillo's own words was that there, he used his friendship and faith to have a relationship with her.
You know, one fact that is missing from this case, which is really troublesome to me, is that Ms. Trujillo apparently never told Amity Plaza about this improper relationship until after the rape occurred, and never gave them notice. And yet now she's trying to hold them liable. Isn't there some obligation to tell a landlord? Was after the rape, when the landlord knew about it, they said, well, we'll move you to a different location. We'll change the keys. But you're holding, your client is seeking to hold them liable when they never were advised that there was a problem in the first place. So it's an absolute liability that you're asserting here. But is there any obligation to give them a chance to correct the problem?
Under the 24 CFR 100.7B, candidly, I don't think there is a requirement that they have actual notice, they could have constructive notice, or that this aided by agency.
So it's an absolute liability is what you're arguing.
I'm not arguing that it's absolute liability. I'm arguing that there has to be a nexus between the harassment and the employment relationship. I'm arguing that plaintiff contends that there's absolute liability when there is an employer-employee relationship.
But they don't need any notice or any opportunity to step in and correct the problem. Even though the plaintiff knew that, I mean, she knew that this had been morphing into a bit of a personal relationship even before the rape, I think. I mean, she had tried to sell artwork through him and they had met in his car and so forth.
I think that goes to illustrate that this was a mutual relationship, that he wasn't using his employment to facilitate his conduct and so facilitating any alleged harassment of plaintiff, and that that's the distinguishment of where there isn't a nexus between his employment and why and the actual harassment that was alleged, the May 3rd, 2021 sexual assault.
Counsel, can I ask you about the nexus? Do we know from the record whether Mr. Martinez could access apartment units without notice or permission of the tenants?
That was not developed in the record, Your Honor.
So what if in this case, the morning of the sexual assault, Mr. Rio had locked her door and Mr. Martinez then used his master key to enter? Would Amity Plaza then be vicariously liable?
I think at that point, then we are looking at he was aided by his having the keys and access to her apartment. And so then you're looking at a situation where under the aided by agency exception, Amity Plaza could be found liable.
Okay, so the line drawing exercise here, if you will, depends on whether the door is locked?
I don't think it's as simple as the door is locked, but whether or not the tools of employment were used to gain access to the plaintiff in the case.
Well, even if the door was locked, I presume he would have knocked first and she would have still opened it.
So there isn't evidence that he knocked prior to entering, or that's a fact in dispute. But they were on the phone throughout the day, the morning leading up to him coming over to her apartment. He said he was coming over and had warned her that he was coming over, and she still left the door unlocked.
I can see why this might be a relevant fact in terms of her ability individually to sue him, but I don't see how that increases or creates any culpability on behalf of the landlord.
I mean, I think that is where Amity Plaza and South Metro Housing Options finds that there's not an opportunity to rectify any poor behavior if they don't have notice of that. But I think looking at the agency case law, our hands are tied with that if he used his tools of employment as a vehicle by which to perpetrate his harassment, even if they didn't have notice, then they could potentially be liable for that. But that's ultimately a question for the jury.
Counsel, both parties this morning have cited to us the HUD regulations, but how much weight should we give to HUD's interpretation of common law principles?
Well, since the Loper decision, that the court shouldn't be giving deference to the HUD regulations because it's an agency regulation, and that they should look at the traditional statutory construction. And looking at that, the backdraw, it is common law tort and vicarious liability principles. And looking at that, there has to be something more than an employer, just a simple employer-employee relationship, and that justifies the position that the defendants are taking. And Your Honor, I'm just at the end of my time. We ask that the court affirm the district court's ruling on summary judgment and remand this with further proceedings consistent with it. Thank you.
Good for you. You're one of the few people that honors their split time.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Shadikovsky, and I have the privilege of representing defendant appellee Frank Martinez. We ask this court to affirm the entry of summary judgment in favor of Mr. Martinez, as there are no disputes of material fact that would support Ms. Trujillo's direct FHA claim against Mr. Martinez that was not resolved by the housing defendant's motion. The law permits district courts at the summary judgment phase to resolve matters sua sponte. The district court did so here, and although Ms. Trujillo was not given advance notice, she has shown no prejudice. The grant of summary judgment was appropriate and should not be reversed on appeal. Ms. Trujillo presented all of her evidence on the FHA claims and has failed to identify any evidence or arguments that she would have presented to the district court had she received advance notice and an opportunity to respond before the motion was granted as to Mr. Martinez. Indeed, the district court's determination was based on issues identical to those raised by the housing defendants. So Ms. Trujillo was given the opportunity to respond to those arguments and present any evidence undermining the district court's ruling. The allegations of wrongdoing against Mr. Martinez would have to be established as a violation of the FHA to support a claim of vicarious liability against the housing defendants. The district court specifically identified all alleged facts of wrongdoing by Mr. Martinez and determined that there is no nexus between his employment as a maintenance employee and the alleged harassment. Those findings were sufficient to determine there was no underlying violation of the FHA for which it could hold the housing defendants vicariously responsible. There is no evidence or allegation that Mr. Martinez exercised any authority in his role to take advantage of or pressure Ms. Trujillo. I would like to add that these are only allegations of harassment, and there has been no finding of rape. There were no criminal charges brought, and Mr. Martinez testified that he believed this to be a mutual friendship. Mr. Martinez worked as a maintenance technician. He had no authority to identify potential tenants or set terms of housing. What might be expected in the FHA context would be uninvited use of keys to access the unit or refusal to perform requested repairs. There is no such allegation or evidence here. Mr. Martinez did not visit Ms. Trujillo under the guise of making repairs or even a maintenance stop. He communicated that he wanted to visit her on a personal reason and advised that he had accepted another position before he visited her on May 3rd, 2021. There is no reasonable basis for Ms. Trujillo to believe that Mr. Martinez used his role as a maintenance technician to commit the wrongdoing. There would be no purpose for the aided in agency exception if all that is required is an introduction between the tenant and an alleged harasser by virtue of the employment relationship. That would be more like a but-for and strict liability test. Ms. Trujillo has not shown any prejudice for the dismissal other than the inability to prosecute her claim. There can be no prejudice when Ms. Trujillo had no other evidence or alternate legal theories to marshal. Ms. Trujillo made no arguments to the district court or to this court regarding the additional evidence she would have it consider with regard to direct liability against Mr. Martinez under the FHA. On appeal, Ms. Trujillo argued for the first time that her arguments as to Mr. Martinez's liability are the same as those arguments that she made as to the housing defendants. Ms. Trujillo has no other arguments or evidence to present in support of this claim. For the same reason, summary judgment is appropriate on the housing defendant's motion for summary judgment regarding vicarious liability, summary judgment is appropriate on Ms. Trujillo's direct liability claim against Mr. Martinez. The law supports the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Mr. Martinez. On behalf of Mr. Martinez, I ask that this court affirm the district court's order confirming the grant of summary judgment as to her claim against Mr. Trujillo, or against Mr. Martinez, and affirm the district court's discretionary decision to decline to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the state law claim.
I take it, I asked the other counsel this, was Martinez in plaintiff's building for maintenance on the day of the rape, or was he in a different building and then came over to her building because it was open?
With the remaining 2 seconds, Judge Ide, may I proceed? Thank you. My understanding from the record, Your Honor, is that Mr. Martinez had responded to a maintenance call at a different building, and he called in advance of entering her building before visiting her apartment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to try to go quick. Your Honors, this was more than just a simple employee relationship, and that's not what we're arguing. By granting Martinez the status as an official representative of the housing department, they provided him the architecture of his predation. His uniform functioned as a badge of trust that lowered Ms. Trujillo's guard. His master keys provided the physical access that rendered her bedroom door a fiction. And according to her testimony, it scared her and intimidated her. And his authorized job site presence and work phone ensured the constant and pervasive contact necessary to isolate and intimidate her. Under the aided in agency doctrine, the assault was not a detour from his duties. To argue that there is no nexus because the assault happened without a work order or use of the key is to ignore the entire path of that assault was paved by the employer's grant of authority, access, and professional credibility. As to the arguments to Mr. Martinez personally, a mutual friendship does not mean that someone shows up to your door in a ski mask and rapes you. He was not there for friendship or a personal call. When he called her 7 times that morning with his personal or with his work provided cell phone, she told him not to come over. The additional arguments and facts that we would have presented had the district court not sua sponte granted summary judgment. While the MSJ response to the housing authority noted that Martinez spoke to Trujillo, full briefing would have used his deposition to show a calculated pattern of using his professional access to groom her. This includes the high frequency of random visits in his uniform, his phone calls, and his intentionally exploitation of the color of authority provided by Amity.
Well, counsel, part of the presentation we just heard, though, was not just what happened in the district court, but what's missing, perhaps, from your brief here before this court, meaning I'm looking at it, I think, two paragraphs in your opening brief about why this sua sponte grant for Mr. Martinez was inappropriate. And as I read it, it's fully derivative of the other arguments of vicarious liability against Amity Plaza. So why isn't that correct?
Your Honors, I believe the Court of Appeals is allowed to remand or reaffirm based on anything in the record. So there are additional facts in the record. I'm over time. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You are excused. And